Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest bonus episode of The Rest is History. And Tom, you are probably feeling a bit gutted, are you? Because you've just been following the cricket that England have lost to India.
Yeah, so England just lost.
Yeah, so dark days.
No, I feel, you know, we did very well in the first test. We've now lost the second test, so it's all to play for.
All to play for, very good.
I should be a football manager.
Well, let's hope you wouldn't be absolutely crucified by your fans.
Which we've just been talking about, haven't we?
We have just been talking about, because we've been talking about Carthage. So we're in the middle of this enormous epic recording session, four episodes on Carthage and building up to the first Punic War. That's right, isn't it?
That's right, yes.
So Hannibal doesn't really enter the story in these first four episodes.
Well, I've been mapping out in my head the story of Carthage. So the first four episodes, the first one is about the Phoenicians. Mm-hmm. The second one is about Carthage. The third one is going to be about the relations between Carthage and Rome before the First Punic War. And then the last one is going to be about the First Punic War.
And the mercenaries.
This terrible, terrible war. I mean, it's awful. So Polybius, the Greek scholar who wrote a history of how Rome came to be the kind of the great Mediterranean superpower, which culminates with the destruction of Carthage.
Yeah.
He said of the mercenaries' war against their Carthaginian employers that no war in history had featured more cruel savagery.
Oh, brilliant. Can't wait.
And he certainly has a point. So the story of that is, I mean, just to give a preview, is that Carthage fights the Romans. It's a terribly long war. It leaves them exhausted. They have to pay an enormous kind of Versailles Treaty type indemnity. And they also have to ship the mercenaries that they've been employing in Sicily back to Carthage. Mm. And the problem is that all these mercenaries have landed outside Carthage and the Carthaginians can't pay them.
Yeah.
So the mercenaries,
they run amok, don't they?
They run amok. And 3 years of terrible war. And the climax of it, the Romans capture this Libyan guy who had been leading the mercenary rebels, and they take him into Carthage, and they, in a kind of parody of the triumphal march that he would have done had he managed to break into Carthage, they make him walk through the streets of the city. And Flaubert describes this in the final chapter of Salammbô, his novel about Carthage, and he specifies that they tie his arms behind his back and they make him walk through the streets. And the rule is that no one is allowed to poke his eyes out so that he has to see the things that are being inflicted on him. And people can only have three goes at wounding him, and they're not allowed to break his legs so he can carry on walking. And Flaubert, obviously, I mean, is he a sadist? I mean, it seems it's a very sadistic book.
Yeah.
And Flaubert's descriptions of the tortures that are visited on him, I imagine Flaubert must have read the Marquis de Sade. Anyway, it's very, very horrible. So that's all something to look forward to.
I read it at university. You had to choose special authors to do. Flaubert was one of my two special authors. And it's such a strange book for him to have done after Madame Bovary. So he'd done Madame Bovary in the 1850s.
Yeah, I mean, it's so unlike Madame Bovary.
And then I think there's 5 years between Madame Bovary and Salammbô. Madame Bovary, which is, for those people who haven't read it, it's the story of a kind of provincial, bored, but idealistic and romantic French woman who has a series of affairs, doesn't she? She's married to this guy who's famous for, he wore the wrong hat at school in the opening chapter. Is it the wrong hat? I think it's the wrong hat or the wrong coat or something.
And she dreams of leaving a small town, doesn't she?
Yeah.
And she never does.
But it's written with the most, I mean, what makes it one of the sort of two or three greatest novels ever written is it's written with the most extraordinary linguistic precision and beauty. And then to go from that, Flaubert's thing is, you know, he would write and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite, total control. To go from that to the unbelievably lurid, semi-pornographic.
Yeah, it really is.
Blood-drenched fantasies of Salammbô.
But did you enjoy it when you read it?
I did. I thought it seemed to be so weird that you would go from Madame Bovary, because we were sort of read the books in order. So you do Madame Bovary first for sort of 2 weeks. And then it was like, well, real change of tone now.
Yeah. But also the odd thing is, which I think critics at the time said, that if you're going to set a novel in Carthage, most novels set in Carthage feature Hannibal because he's the really famous one.
Yes. Yeah.
But the story of the mercenaries' war, I mean, not only is it obscure, but it's revolting.
Yeah. There clearly is some kind of psychological thing going on with Flaubert here, right? It's almost sort of the contrast between the obsession with control in the other book, the previous book, and the sort of the desire and all that.
Yeah, just letting it all out.
And then completely, yeah, letting it all out. Absolutely.
Is it also, the French are moving in on North Africa at this point?
Yes, they are.
And so the Carthaginians and the French are often compared.
Yeah.
And I think there's a sense of, I mean, you know, Genet or Fanon would be all over the idea that this is about suppressed metropolitan desire to inflict violence on rebellious natives. I don't know.
I think it could be something like that, Tom. Ferber did go, by the way. He went to Carthage to conduct research. He probably found what I found when I went to Carthage, which is, I know you roll your eyes at this, but there's just a load of old stones, like of no great interest.
Nothing wrong with a bit of old stones.
Yeah, you would love to take your family, no doubt, on holiday.
I never have done. I've never been.
But I wouldn't massively recommend Tunis as a tourist destination.
Well, that's why I've never gone, to be honest.
Anyway, yes.
Any other excitements?
What other excitements? So last week we did The Man in the Iron Mask and The Romans in Space. This week we're in the middle of the Peasants' Revolt, aren't we?
So we've done the Peasants' Revolt. So everyone has had the Peasants' Revolt, Richard II and Chaucer.
They'll have had Richard II and Chaucer, of course they will.
Yes.
And then after that, I think, are we into 1974?
We are. So that's four episodes that are going out in a single week, isn't it?
Single week. We spoiled the rest of History Club members, don't we?
Before we get on to the questions, could I just mention a very entertaining series that I've been watching on Netflix?
Do.
Which actually came out a while ago.
Yeah.
And maybe you've seen it, Barbarians.
No, I've seen clips of it. It's the Germans against the Romans, isn't it?
Yes. It's Varus who led three legions into the Teutoburg Wood. And they got wiped out. And it tells the story of Arminius, who is in this, the adopted son of Varus, and betrays him. And it features Thusnelda, who is a historical figure. And she's a kind of sassy, kick-ass, barbarian superhero.
Mm.
It's great fun. And the Romans all speak in Latin. So highly recommended.
So you recommend it?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
So one other thing we did last week, which people will undoubtedly enjoy, I hope, when it comes out, is our history of chocolate.
Oh, yes, of course.
That was jolly good fun, wasn't it?
Yes.
So unusually, we did that in person.
In the studio.
Very unusual for us. We were in the studio in the same room. And so we do everything from the Olmecs and the Aztecs and chocolate all the way through to kind of 19th century Britain and paternalistic employers and Quakers, Tom. You like a Quaker, don't you?
I love a Quaker.
Yes. And the chocolate is a window into lots of other things. So that's something to look forward to as well. So shall we have some questions? Now, here's one that is just a gift to you, Tom. It's your standard question, actually. It's from Reticus. Reticus is coming to this having listened to the episode on Romans in Space. And Reticus says, lots of people say that the mystical energy in Star Wars, the Force, is often seen as inspired by Taoism and Buddhism. But do you believe that the sensibilities and morality of the Star Wars films are more Christian?
Okay, so I've got two answers to this.
Yeah.
The first is, if in any way I gave the impression that I know anything really about Star Wars in that episode we recorded,
yeah,
it was a brilliant act, because I really don't know anything about it, really.
Oh.
I haven't watched them since I was about 10.
Yeah. Okay.
So I can't really remember. I did see the first one of the new ones.
Force Awakens. Or The Phantom Menace, are you talking about?
I can't remember what it's called. It's the one where it's all about trade negotiations.
That's not even the new ones, Tom. I mean, you're 20 years out of date.
Fine.
That's The Phantom Menace, one of the worst films ever made.
Okay. So I honestly have no idea. But my take on it would be, I suspect it's extremely unlikely that any of this stuff underpins it. Because as far as I can tell, I mean, it's just George Lucas kind of mixing stuff in.
Yeah.
And maybe a bit later saying, oh, yeah, well, I was inspired by this or inspired by that.
I think there's lots of truth in that, Tom. I noticed somebody pushed back against that on social media or something. They said, I in particular have been very dismissive of these important influences. But I mean, there's such a thing as putting an intolerably heavy load on something that's ultimately Flash Gordon.
I mean, the thing is, the plot requires King Arthur.
Yeah.
You know, he's a farm boy. He has no obvious way of taking on the empire. So you can imagine George Lucas sitting there thinking, well, how am I going to get this farm boy into a position where he can stop the Death Star?
Yeah.
And then you would, as a science fiction writer, think, well, maybe there's a secret power that only he can access.
Yeah.
And then you'd start thinking, well, what is this secret power? How come he can access it and other people can't? And then you might start thinking, well, maybe there's a secret order of people who can, and you can see how that would develop. I don't think you'd sit down and say, I'm very influenced by Taoism.
Exactly.
Or indeed by, you know, the Templars.
Yeah, agreed.
How can I reproduce this in ancient space? I don't think that's how it would work. I think you'd come up with the plot.
Agreed.
And then you might chuck in a kind of knowing an allusion, perhaps, to dignify it. But I'm guessing that's how he did it.
I think that's absolutely right.
And I'm guessing the same is true of the Roman stuff. I mean, the echoes clearly are there, but they're
unconscious. They're unconscious.
I don't think he's sitting down and thinking, as Asimov did with Foundation. Asimov was absolutely thinking, I want to do Gibbon in space. I don't think Lucas was doing that.
No. I agree with you, Tom. I agree with you. It's a bit like the thing we talked about, the Joseph Campbell thing, the hero with a thousand faces or whatever.
Yeah.
Which was later claimed as this tremendous inspiration. I mean, come on. People are perfectly capable of coming up with science fiction stories without sort of delving into anthropological studies. So
Jesse B, who is history's Jar Jar Binks. Jar Jar Binks is he's the kind of one that everyone hated, didn't they, in The Phantom Menace?
Yeah. He's got a sort of Jamaican accent.
Right.
So I don't know who the analogy would be. I suppose Justin Trudeau, maybe.
Yeah, well, there you go. An excellent answer.
All right. So let's have some questions about the Peasants' Revolt. First of all, a question one would hope slightly tongue-in-cheek from John R. Rickelid. He asks, Tom, which revolution in English history would you most likely have joined?
I think I would have fought at Fairfax's side in the English Civil War.
Not you?
Yeah. Black Tom.
Is that what you'd be called?
Fairfax was called Black Tom.
Okay, fair enough. I didn't know that, actually.
I could be called Grey Tom.
Right. I like to imagine myself, you remember the levellers, Tom, at Burford?
You wouldn't have been a leveller.
Wait a second, I'd like to think of myself as being one of the people who shot them.
Right. With Cromwell.
With Cromwell.
You'd be with Ireton.
I'm very much on Team Cromwell generally in the 1640s and 50s. I mean, that is on record. Very popular, goes down really well with my Irish in-laws.
So we would both have been on the parliamentarian side then?
I think so, although I think you're more of a cavalier, aren't you? You're more of a cavalier in kind of outlook. And
no.
No?
Because you think about the nobleman.
Yeah.
Because what's it, the John Adamson book, The Noble's Revolt. I mean, he casts the whole thing as being...
A noble coup.
A coup by the nobles.
Yes.
I think I'd be part of that sophisticated, continental, aristocratic culture.
You think you would be?
Yeah. They all had floppy hats.
You would be. I think you absolutely would be. You'd have met them at literary parties.
Yes. You'd be in your russet coat.
Totally. Totally. That's my self-image anyway.
Smashing stained glass windows.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'd have been at the harpsichord. But we'd both have been on the same side.
Oh, no. I see. You're saying you'd be what part of that noble... Right.
Yeah. So I would be Fairfax and you'd be Cromwell at Marston Moor.
Yeah. But you'd have to go eventually in about the late 1640s, early 1650s. You'd be saying it's gone too far.
Yeah, I would.
And I'd say, no, let the army run everything.
Sadie would appear wearing a black mask and shout royalist slogans at you.
She'd shame you. She'd shame you, Tom.
She'd shame you, Dominic.
Old Celt, what are the differences between French rebellions and those that happened in England? That's a good question. Do you have an answer to that, Tom?
Are we talking in the 14th century? Are we talking the Jacquerie?
I think we are talking 14th century. Yeah, is the difference between the Jacquerie and the Peasants' Revolt? The Peasants' Revolt is not by peasants. I think that's a key thing to say about it, isn't it?
So the Jacquerie, Jacques is a peasant, and they were peasants.
Yeah.
And so they get put down very brutally. And as you say, I think the whole thing about the Peasants' Revolt is it's not really a peasants' revolt.
Yeah.
It's much more aligned to the rebellions in Flanders.
Okay.
Where you get kind of workers who are, rather in a similar way, hostile to kind of closed shops and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Slightly Thatcherite quality to it.
Yeah, that's right. Pujadists. Pierre Pujard was a French politician of the 1950s.
Yes. I don't think there's much Thatcherism in the Jacquerie.
Okay, fair enough. All right, Dido.
Dido's question. What would have happened if, when Richard met the rebels, they had killed him there and then? Unlikely, I know, given the sacral nature of kingship. But might we have seen an Oliver Cromwell-like situation 3 centuries early? Or would it have turned the anger of the people against the rebels? That is a good question, because it could have happened.
Oh yeah, it totally could have happened.
What would have happened if they'd killed Richard?
A new king.
There would have been a new king, of course.
Who would it have been?
It would be Edward of March.
So who's he?
He's the one who's...
Son of Lionel or something?
Yes, through a female line.
Okay.
And so they suddenly have to start applying Salic law when Henry IV comes to power.
So would there have been an Oliver Cromwell situation? No, absolutely not. In no way. I mean, that's totally implausible. There's none of the sort of millenarian political enthusiasm that you get in the 1640s in the late 14th century. I mean, there is religious enthusiasm, but it's totally different.
Oh, completely. I mean, there'd be no question of them replacing the monarchy. I mean, it wouldn't even be a possibility. But I'm guessing the reprisals would have been brutal.
Yeah, incredibly brutal. And it would have sent, in the rest of the country, news, you know, rebels have murdered a boy king, you know, in cold blood, as it were.
Who'd gone out to negotiate with them.
That would be a very big deal.
And of course, the rebels know that.
Yeah.
I mean, which is why, you know, they don't kill him.
Yeah, of course. I think it's an interesting thing. We've talked about this a few times. We're often asked about the lessons of history, aren't we? And we always say, oh, there's no lessons of history. But of course, one genuine lesson of history is that if you're planning to rebel or do anything of that kind,
go all in.
At no point can you back down. You have to seize complete power and kill everybody. Because if you do a Mr. Prigozhin in Russia, you will definitely be killed.
Bolts will be taken out of your plane.
Right. I mean, what Tyler, he has to kill everybody or he's going to die himself, basically.
I mean, I suppose they genuinely thought they were on the king's side. The king would look after them. The king was concerned for them. I mean, obviously, comically wrong. But I mean, as we discussed in the episode, there was, I think, an element that Richard did adopt a kind of paternalistic attitude to them.
Yeah.
And it probably meant all the more to him for the fact that he was so young. I mean, there's nothing a teenager enjoys more than feeling paternalistic.
I guess so. But I guess the amazing thing is not so much that they were so naive as that later people never learned the lesson. So like the Pilgrimage of Grace or somebody. Oh, yeah, we'll all go home. It'll all be fine. The king will, you know.
But Henry VIII was much more brutal than Richard II.
Yeah.
You know, there were not terrible reprisals after the Peasants' Revolt, actually.
Well, Henry VIII was, do you know what I'm going to say, Tom? I think he was just a better king. He was a good king.
He was. I mean, he didn't end up murdered. So by definition.
Yeah, he died peacefully in his bed. His heirs inherited the throne. His dynasty was reasonably secure. He got what he wanted. I mean, this thing about Henry VIII, he was actually quite a good king. Mm. Anyway, spiraled off. Tom, what's your favourite Canterbury tale? This is for Samwise the Brave. Samwise the Brave wants to know.
I mean, the most fun is the Miller's Tale.
The Miller's Tale is the one with breaking wind out of windows and stuff like that.
It's farts, brands, yeah. People kissing the arse.
Yes.
But I think the greatest is the Pardoner's Tale. And it's the greatest, not just because it's a brilliant story in itself, but because it's told by such a repellent figure.
Okay, yeah.
So the tension that generates is amazing. And then it has one of the funniest segments after it. The Pardoner is so carried away by how brilliant his story has been that he then starts trying to extort money out of the pilgrims. And there's something to the effect, he turns around and says, I think I will begin with the man who is most steeped in sin, and turns to Harry Bailey, the host, who gets incredibly pissed off and threatens to punch him, and the whole thing degenerates. So what had been this very heightened, sophisticated, dark kind of nexus of theology and menace, suddenly it's a massive punch-up. And I think something about testicles is mentioned as well.
All right.
Going to kick him in the nuts or something.
Right. The only tale I really remember is The Merchant's Tale, because we did it for A-level. And the only thing I actually remember about that is the one line, and in he throng, which we all thought was brilliant. Yeah, but I don't remember anything else about it at all. So that's sad.
I commend, obviously, The Wife of Bath's prologue.
Yeah, you love The Wife of Bath, don't you?
So her tale is fine. I mean, it's not the best tale, but her prologue is just astonishing. I mean, amazing piece of writing. Anyway, sticking to the literary theme, question from Jesse B again, who's on fire. Mm-hmm. Love the historical mystery episodes. So that's, I guess, a reference to The Man in the Iron Mask. You both seem to have a fondness for detective fiction. What is your favourite detective novel? And should you, God forbid, meet a mysterious demise, which fictional detective would you like to solve the case?
Great question. Murder of Roger Ackroyd, I was going to say. What are you going to say?
I mean, I think Sherlock Holmes is my favourite. It's such a cliched answer.
Right. Your favourite detective. The thing is with Sherlock Holmes, it's often said, he doesn't actually do that much detecting.
No, it's the vibe.
Agreed. I mean, Poirot is the more methodical and insightful detective, I would say. And obviously, Miss Marple's grasp of human nature, Tom, is unrivaled. I'll tell you a good detective novel, a brilliant detective novel, The Name of the Rose. We were talking about that with Tabby, our assistant producer, last week. What a brilliant book The Name of the Rose is.
Yeah, it is. But William of Baskerville in that.
Yeah.
Is Sherlock Holmes.
He is indeed.
I mean, you know, the allusion to Baskerville.
Yeah.
And of course, it's written by Umberto Eco, who's Italian. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it's quite a tribute.
It is indeed.
To Sherlock Holmes, that he makes his hero a kind of recognisably Sherlockian. And so I think that when I say my favourite detective is Sherlock Holmes, I'm thinking at least as much of the illustrations as I am of the actual stories.
Oh, yeah.
Thinking of that one where he and Watson are on the train. And he's got his deerstalker and he's kind of explaining a point.
Yeah.
I love all that.
That's what you're looking for.
Yeah. The kind of, you know, the rattling of hansom cabs, the swirling of the fog.
Right.
Pea soupers, all that kind of thing. But yeah, I think Poirot you'd probably want, wouldn't you? Kind of depends what the crime is.
The thing is, if I'm dead, I don't really care.
But you might not be dead. I mean, that might be the twist.
That's the twist. Very good. Yeah.
Maybe you've arranged your own murder.
Okay. Very good.
I'm just, you know, thinking outside the box here.
Yeah. Okay, totally different note for you, Tom. This is from our old friend Tony Bang, and he wants to know, now I know this is the subject of a whole series in itself, potentially. Who do you really blame for the fall of Constantinople? Do you blame the Eastern Roman emperors themselves? Do you blame the Turks? It's harsh to blame the Turks. I mean, the Turks obviously are kind of responsible, but do you blame the Ottomans, or do you blame the Italian cities of Venice and Genoa, and indeed the Crusaders?
I blame the Crusaders.
Yeah, definitely. The Crusaders behaved very poorly then, didn't they?
It's the most shocking moment in European history.
Though Constantinople does then, or the empire does sort of stagger on for another 250 years.
I know, but it's awful. It's like, you know, the living dead.
Yeah. Zombie Rome.
It's zombie Rome. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think it's bad leadership necessarily.
They're doing their best, aren't they?
Yeah. People always say, oh, it's very poor leadership when states have nothing but bad options. The context is such that they can't actually show anything but bad.
I mean, the thing that's amazing, of course, about the Byzantine Empire isn't that it ultimately falls, but that it lasts as long as it does. Because how it survives the 7th and 8th centuries,
yeah,
I don't really know.
Do you know what, Tom? This is something. I've got a new book by Anthony Kaldelis. Do you know this guy?
I do, yeah.
He's just written a new history, the first big new history in a generation of the Eastern Roman Empire. He calls it the New Roman Empire.
He's very keen on that, isn't he? Very, very keen that it's Roman.
And he's very particular about the naming. So all the emperors who you and I know as Leo the Third or something, he calls them, which I find deflating, he calls them Leon. And he insists on, you know, everybody having the right Greek name. He's having no truck with, you know, anglicized names or anything.
Yeah.
And he's very big on this whole thing about Romania, you know, Romania. And he's really into all this.
I mean, the weird thing is that Muslim historians are much more alert to that than Western ones.
Yeah.
You know, the Sultanate of Rum.
Yeah, Rumelia.
Rumelia. I mean, the idea of what we call the Byzantine Empire being Rome, being Roman, you know, is shot through the Muslim understanding of it.
He says in his book, in the preface, because I was looking at it over the weekend when I actually should have been doing real work, he said there was almost a concerted effort by Western Christendom to downplay the Romanness of the East because, you know, obviously Charlemagne and his successors wanted to claim Rome's legacy for themselves.
And the papacy.
But also, as time went on, it was in the West's interest to kind of push the Eastern Roman Empire to the margins and pretend it wasn't really Roman.
Yeah.
Do you think there's some truth in that?
Yeah, I completely do. When I did In the Shadow of the Sword, I made a point of always calling it the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
The whole way through. And I think even in Millennium as well, I can't remember whether then I was as keen. But I mean, if I was rewriting Millennium now, which covers the 10th and 11th centuries,
yeah,
I'd definitely call them Romans.
Romans, yeah.
I think Byzantines, it's one of those distancing words that obscures.
Agreed.
What you're actually writing about.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an 18th century word, really.
Yeah.
Which is why Gibbon casts this tremendous shadow over so much ancient and medieval history. And so many of the myths that we have about ancient and medieval history derive from the Enlightenment. And of course, the whole Enlightenment project is about banishing myths. But in fact, they just create even more enduring myths.
New myths. Like the myth of the Christians destroying all the old texts. And that's a myth, isn't it?
Yeah. So Hypatia would be a kind of classic example.
Yeah.
You know, this philosopher in Alexandria who supposedly gets lynched for being a philosopher by evil Christians. But it's not true. So anyway, very interesting.
Oh, it's James. What's more important to British history? Is such a gift for you, Tom, again. But it's a difficult question. What's more important for British history, the Protestant Reformation or the Industrial Revolution?
I think the Industrial Revolution is the most significant change.
Golly, it's very unusual for you, Tom, to...
I mean, the Industrial Revolution changes everything.
Yeah.
In ways that we cannot begin... Obviously, I wouldn't downplay the significance of the Reformation. That's incredibly important. But nothing is comparable to the changes initiated by the Industrial Revolution. I mean, I suppose one bit of wriggle room might be to say, you know, the Industrial Revolution happens in the Dutch Republic and in England, which are both Protestant. You know, is there a connection? This is a kind of hardy perennial as a topic of discussion.
Are they the same thing, Tom? But actually, the other places that rival Britain as birthplaces of industry, say, for example, in Belgium, that's Catholic.
Yeah.
Belgium was very highly industrialized, and that kind of undermines the idea that it's just Protestantism.
Yeah.
I think actually the possession of coal is more important than the absence of stained glass.
Yes, and shipping lanes open to the world.
Yeah. I suppose the Protestant Reformation, lots of places have a Protestant Reformation, but Britain is unusual in having an industrial revolution so early. and so completely.
Well, unique.
Yeah, exactly. It is unique.
Yeah, so Industrial Revolution. There are two great seismic transformations in human history. And the first is the agricultural revolution, which enables people to generate surpluses and thereby urbanism and everything that follows.
Yes.
And then the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
And everything else, to a degree, is just kind of surface.
Agreed. And then possibly third, wolves inventing Europe in the 1950s.
Yeah, very good. So one last question, Dominic, for you.
Yes.
And this is from Clusks.
Clusks is anticipating the 1974 series.
Clusks is almost at the end of Dominic's book, State of Emergency, and notices that you quote Kenneth Williams a lot, but you never really dedicate much writing to him in the book. What do you think of Kenneth, and did you enjoy reading through, presumably, all his diaries? So Kenneth Williams, for those who don't know, was an actor in the Carry On series, which is the most British comedy series of all time.
Yeah, how do you explain that to non-British listeners?
He spoke like that. Oh.
Yeah, he's very camp, wasn't he?
Yes.
He's somebody who's slightly...
feline.
Yeah. If you think of Britain pre-1970s or something as monolithically homophobic, Kenneth Williams slightly complicates and unsettles that because he's somebody who never is open about his sexuality.
But everyone knows.
But everyone kind of knows, and that's the joke. And that has been the joke in his career since the 1940s or something. Sort of the campness, the playing with his sexuality. Anyway.
So he plays Julius Caesar in Carry On Cleo.
Yes, he does.
And has the great line where he bursts in, infamy, infamy, they've all got it in for me.
Yes.
Which I think was voted the greatest line in a British comedy of all time and was coined by the father of my friend Jamie Muir, Frank Muir.
Frank Muir, no way.
Yeah, he wrote that line.
Right. Kenneth Williams, he's incredibly misanthropic. He writes this amazing diary during the sort of 1960s, 1970s. He's very, very reactionary in lots of things. And he's very interested in politics. So he's very acerbic about all the kind of goings on in Britain. His diary is wonderful, actually, because the two things that he gives you is one, the very acerbic commentary on the politics of the day. And two, because he's based in London and he's kind of, he's always going to auditions and to do radio broadcasts and things. And he writes about what happened to him on the walk to the studio and stuff. You do get a real sense of that kind of shabby world of 1970s London.
I've never read them.
He's also very, he's very depressive. He's always going on about his health. I mean, he ended up taking his own life, didn't he, in the 1980s, late 1980s, maybe? I can't remember.
Yeah.
But he's a great character. I think that's what you always look for as a historian.
He's like a kind of camp Philip Larkin.
Yes. Yeah, he's equally gloomy.
Reactionary.
He's similarly committed to the idea that ultimately miners should be hanged, which Larkin believes.
Bring back the cat.
Yeah, bring back the cat. Bring back flogging. He's absolutely into all that. But he's funnier than Larkin because Larkin's not very funny in his diaries. He's just gloomy.
All right. Well, I think we've talked enough. We have amused you enough, entertained you enough, I hope. So what have we got coming up? We have next week, we've got 1974.
We do.
So the four episodes. Then we've got Carthage.
Yeah. Over 2 weeks.
And then we have Chocolate and we have History's Top 7 Monkeys.
Oh, the monkeys are coming. Brilliant. Looking forward to the monkeys. Great. Loads to look forward to. So thank you as ever for all your support. If you're an Athelstan, you'll just have taken part in the quiz. Very excitingly.
Of course, yeah.
I've done my questions, Tom. Have you done yours?
I've been too busy with Carthage.
Oh, well. On that bombshell, we will see you all next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.